going back to adoption, the biggest thing for me was being abandoned. And so my big moments of pain are losing people in my life. It was a little after 4 p.m. when the call came out for the active shooter at the municipal center. I had to go in for myself because of who I was to go inside that building, to go and protect other people, to go in to have my brother's back. I have this light or this fire and this flame that I can come bring to other people that are experiencing their darkness and unable to get out of that. Things are unfolding for me in ways that I could not have planned for them to unfold, but it all feels right where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with former SWAT operator Laura G. Hansen about overcoming suffering by shifting the perspective on pain, Laura's active shooter incident in 2019, and her memoir, Why I Went In. We invite you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, all the podcast platforms, and our website is ResponderTV.com, past episodes, and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Laura after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW, EMTB. Today we're joined by former SWAT operator Laura G. Hansen, who's the author of the memoir Why I Went In, and she's also the CEO of Rain Bucket Coaching and a keynote speaker. She's a former police officer and SWAT team operator with the Virginia Beach Police Department, serving as the only female on the full-time SWAT team for over 4 years. While on SWAT, Hansen received the Silver Cross for responding to an active shooter at Building 2 on May 31st, 2019, and was also part of the team's sniper cell. After leaving the police department, Laura became a certified high-performance coach and is passionate about helping other first responders to live a fulfilled and enjoyable life despite the ongoing hardships of the job. Laura, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you, David. So great to be here with you today.
It's great to have you, Laura. And before David gets into one of the first questions we wanted to ask, I just want to highlight the amount of work that you're doing. You're such a champion for this topic, which definitely aligns with our mission. But your book, and I know that a lot of exciting things are happening for you. And I just want to commend you for just speaking your truth and standing in your power, because those things are infectious in a good way. And I feel we'd be remiss if we didn't commend you for that.
Thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
And offline, we were speaking about how powerful it is when a person who is a current or former first responder is authentic in sharing their journey, and how that can affect other first responders who might be struggling. And so I wanted to dive into kind of a deep topic, because as myself, as a parent who's adopted a child, I've witnessed what my child went through being given up by biological parents, and then how that can create deep core wounds. So can you share a little bit about your early life and the role it played in your quest for personal growth?
Sure, absolutely. So I was given up for adoption right from birth. I grew up always knowing. My parents were very open about it, and this is my Hansen family. I was mostly okay with it. I mean, my Hansen family was great. We lived in a wonderful house. I played travel soccer. I was fortunate to go on family vacations, things like that. But it seemed like whenever I hit those low points, it just opened the door for going even deeper and even lower. And it became more of a Okay, why am I even here in the first place? Why am I with this family? Why am I not with my biological family? And it's for a child, got to remember, I'm not thinking about this rationally. I'm thinking about this from a point of feeling and pain, because that's the mindset the kids are in. So everything just felt like I didn't belong and I didn't have some type of connection with anybody that would make me feel like I was safe in my person. So it led to me feeling very detached, and it would come and go. So it wasn't an always Monday through Sunday type of feeling, but when it came, I just felt some of the lowest feelings that I've ever felt. And not only that, I was feeling these things before I was even 10 years old, just questioning my overall existence and the purpose of my life.
Well, I can chime in also as someone who had a similar situation, and there's a feeling underneath it all of like being unwanted, or why didn't anybody want me? Right.
Exactly.
And I feel like that surfaces at different times of your life, depending on what developmental stage you're in as well.
Exactly. And it kept coming back to this theme. So anytime I would get into this, phase of disappointment, or arguments would happen,
right,
low points, bad points, everything starts coming back again to, well, what am I even here for at all? Why am I here? I felt like I was being punished, and I didn't necessarily have a spiritual practice when I was younger. My family went to church a couple times that I remember, but I was just trying to figure out why I deserved to be in so much pain, because it felt like I was in far more pain than anyone around me was experiencing. And my pain was then transferred into anger for being misunderstood and feeling like not only am I in pain that I feel like I don't understand, but nobody else seems to be validating my pain. And it seems like they're looking at me as if I shouldn't be in this amount of pain, which then frustrated me. And there are plenty of people who have witnessed my anger as a younger child that can attest, yeah, she was angry. It was all coming from this point of pain.
But it's such an interesting conversation around the difference between suffering and pain, because we talk about suffering and we talk about pain, but can you talk a little more about what each one of those is and how they're different?
So for me, they were one and the same for the longest time, until I'm going through this personal discovery that I went through at the end of being 31. At the time, suffering to me when I was growing up and younger, suffering was like I'm being punished for being alive. Like there's some reason I'm supposed to be alive, but it doesn't seem like it's any reason that I want to be a part of, that I'm just here to live and take in pain, be the recipient of pain, and it's going to keep coming back in my life. So even if I'm happy again after feeling some painful experience, it's just going to lead me to another painful experience. And so when I think of suffering, I think of eternity, not temporariness, whereas pain I now can grasp as just a temporary moment or experience or time period in our lives. And that pain will in fact return, but my mindset around it is that it has to happen, and not that it's being done to me. I'm not necessarily a victim to pain, because I see that all of us go through pain in our lives. And, what I'm saying isn't anything new, but it's however we're perceiving it. And again, I was perceiving it like I'm going to experience pain. I might be happy again, but then I'm going to go back there. So it gets to the point of, well, what's the point? What's the point of getting happy again if I'm just going to be in pain? Why don't I just stay where I'm at? And why even try? Why do anything to improve my life if it's just going to be all taken away from me again? Because going back to adoption, the biggest thing for me was being abandoned. And so my big moments of pain are losing people in my life. So from my biological family to, relationships that I started having, and then being shown over and over again, hey, you're unworthy of love. You're unworthy of pain. Or no, you're worthy of pain. And then kind of tying those two together into just feeling like this is it. I'm stuck here. I'm just meant to suffer. And I keep getting shown the same thing over and over again. And that's being abandoned.
Do you think that going through those feelings led you to law enforcement so you could help others and have that feeling of helping the world because you weren't able to be helped in some way? And then in turn, being a police officer brought back the pain. So I'm wondering how you sort of connect all those dots of what I just said.
It's interesting because in retrospect, I would say absolutely yes. But at the time, there was no intention of entering law enforcement specifically for that reason. But right. This is where, you know, my spiritual practice comes into play, saying, okay, God led me down this route in order right. to be able to really help others in a way that would end up helping myself see my own difficulty and struggling. So I think everything I went through as a child allowed me to connect and be more compassionate for people that I would encounter as an officer. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't intentional for me to say, okay, I experienced all this pain. In fact, I did a ride along before the academy started, and I show up and an officer showed me around the precinct and sort of disgruntled. Other officer shows up and he says, why do you want to be a cop? He's like, did you get picked on a lot as a kid? I didn't even know what to say at the time. I didn't have the confidence I do now. It's just kind of like, what in the heck? How am I supposed to even answer that? I don't know. I'm just here. But it kind of makes sense now that, you know, I look back at it, not so much as, you know, being picked on as a kid, but seeing, yeah, I went through a lot and now I'm going to help other people through what I've been through.
Right. When you retire, you're just another employee that's gone. In 10 years, you'll be, oh yeah, that's good old what's his name.
And sometimes I think for a lot of us, it's scary to retire when you've been raised by an organization for almost 3 decades.
There's a running joke that says that as you retire, you're forgotten about before you even meet the parking lot.
It wasn't that I was losing the passion for the job. I decided I wanted to go ahead and transition and start traveling and talking to groups of people.
I lost who I was. I didn't have any plans for the future. I sunk.
And we're always saving for a rainy day. And what ends up happening is you die and you never receive the benefit of you working so hard for so long.
It's as if you've lost a loved one. For me, there's a sadness there.
They really do become your second family.
I was a firefighter. That was always what I wanted to do. Sometimes life throws you a curveball and you find yourself without an identity.
I would pass police cars and it was like somebody punched me in the stomach. Like I got sick because I missed it so bad.
When you say I'm a retired firefighter, people, they notice. And they're like, wow, man, that's incredible. And it provides an avenue for you to be impactful.
And I don't mean to make it sound so linear and so conscious, because typically, you know, what we see in our offices is the opposite. You know, there's no awareness of why someone became a member of that profession. It's more like of honor and loyalty and duty to others, right? But they don't really connect with how we're saying it. So mm-hmm. I think it's much more subconscious, you know?
I 100% agree.
And now when you can go back and look at it, you realize why.
It makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It really helps me see what my value was to the profession. And right. It has everything to do with all of what I was bringing to the table. And then that was being honed into how to be an officer. But, you know, every officer brings themselves to every single call as well.
That's right.
Sure. And just to kind of wrap up the discussion about pain, like what strategies do you have for facing pain and is suffering a choice? Like, is that something we can just sort of decide that we're not going to do?
My strategy for facing pain has come to me through a lot of own self-discovery, but it's interesting. In my book, you see it's called the Lavender and Honey Exercise, because I would do this at a coffee shop where the atmosphere was great, made me feel like I was safe. And that was important to me because I needed to feel like I could start facing those inner demons and not feel like I was in an unsafe environment to do so. Really open up myself to vulnerability. So what I found is effective for me is to make a list of every painful experience that I've ever been through. And it's not easy to do, but if I just make that list, then I go sit down with a notebook, look at that list and say, okay, you know, something from my book. I mentioned my former wife having an affair on me. So I take that example and then I start journaling about it as if I was back in that moment. And what that allows me to do is it allows me to really resurface all of those painful emotions that I was experiencing at that time. But then I can talk to myself, or, you know, as I like to say, coach myself through what I'm experiencing. So in the moment, all of these painful moments that I'm writing down, I felt like I was alone. I felt like nobody understood me. I felt like I didn't have a friend, a family member, a loved one. Again, for me, it's everything comes down to abandonment. And when I felt abandoned, those are the lowest points of my life when I've questioned, what am I living for? And do I want to live anymore? Mm-hmm. So for me, that's why it's so important to revisit them. But the objective here is to write down the feelings and the hurt and experience them and feel them all over again, and then provide what I needed to hear at the time. What I would have wanted to hear, what I would have needed somebody else in that room with me saying to me in order for me to not feel alone. So it's almost like this is those feelings are on a, I'm going to throw it back to saying CD. So it's on a track, it's on the CD, it's on playlist number one, and it's just playing inside of me all the time, even if I'm just going about my normal life. So when I sit down and I say, I'm going to listen to number one, and I'm going to sit there and feel everything that I was experiencing at the time, and then I'm going to provide that comfort to myself, it allows me to turn the volume down on number one. And it allows me to say, okay, I'm listening to this. I know I can make it through this. I know I get through this. And at first, when I do this, it's a lot more difficult, and it becomes something where I just have to say, like, hey, it's okay. It's okay. I know this hurts. It's very simple, because just think about real time when you're with somebody and they're hurting, you know, you don't start strategizing and figuring out the next 5 years of their life. They just need you there in the moment with them. So the important thing that, though, is that I get up, I go about my life, and then I come back that same exercise, and then I revisit track number one again. I say, okay, well, last time it was on volume 85. This time I'm revisiting it at volume 60, which is important because now I'm saying, okay, that part of me is able to hear more of what I'm going to say. So now it becomes, I know you're upset, and I know that you want to get into this huge fight with her when she comes back, but don't do that. Okay. There's things that are happening for you in your future, you know, essentially talking through it to myself and giving the guidance that I need. But all of this is being like that friend or that loved one to my inner self. And as I start to say, like, you're right. Okay. Maybe this isn't the end of my life. Maybe this isn't the end for me. But the important thing is, the lower I turn that volume in this one particular hurtful experience, then the better I heal as my present day self, because I'm no longer being troubled by those same thoughts. Because if not, if track number one is still playing, whether I'm conscious of it or not, I'm still questioning, is this the end of my life? Should I keep going? And then I'm just going to start looking for evidence from the world of that's going to confirm, yeah, this is the end, and don't do that. So then the next time I experience something, if I haven't dealt with track number one, and now track number two is saying the same thing. I told you, track number one, that you shouldn't live anymore, that you, there's nothing here. This is it. We've already finished. Now track number two, it's telling you the same exact thing. And now everything's piling on top of each other until you get to track 10, everything's on volume 85. And that's when I don't want to find out whether or not I'm going to end up killing myself, you know? So for me, it's, I have to deal with this stuff so that we're not building one painful experience on top of the other, because that's where I was at by the time I got to that point in my life where my second wife is having the affair on me. And I'm looking back at all of the prior abandonment that I had in my life from day one. And now here I am in my second marriage. And guess what? It's happening to me yet again. Somebody's leaving me. Somebody's telling me I'm worthy of love. I've got 31 years of proof that I'm unworthy of love, and I haven't been dealing with it. And my brain is now looking for reasons why I don't want to deal with this anymore. And the only way to not deal with this anymore is to end my own life.
Well, I'm amazed at what you're describing, because it's something I do in my office all the time with first responders when we're doing EMDR. It's called internal family systems, inner parts work. And what you're basically describing is what we guide people through in EMDR. And sometimes we have the present self go back to the child self or the teenage self or the 20-year-old self and give them what they needed. And I'm amazed that you've figured out how to do that on your own, and that really what you're doing is so reparative of the trauma. And every time you revisit it, you're desensitizing the trauma as well. And I wish that people hearing this could really do what you're suggesting, because I think there's so much more healing that people can do with themselves. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to do 100%, right? If someone could start doing that work like you did, it would put you further ahead. You know, it builds resilience.
Come on. Check it.
Which kind of leads me into what I wanted to say to you next, which was, you've been through a lot and you've been very candid in your memoir about that. What do you think built you to the resilience that you have right now?
I have to say, without knowing again, but now I would say it was God playing a role in my life. I say that after really forming and creating a relationship with God when I was 31 years old. But I look back to the first time I started really questioning, why am I alive? And looking at just how thoughts of suicide were running through my brain at a very young age. But it never made sense for me to kill myself, because it was like, you know, I had wanted other, I mentioned this in my book, I had wanted myself to take the place of another kid so that another kid wouldn't be suffering and let me suffer instead, because I'm already here. You know, don't take their life, take my life. And then I started realizing, well, God's not really listening to me. You know, I'm asking for something and I'm still here. I'm still alive going through life. So it was like things started clicking with me that, okay, I might not know what I'm here for, but it seems like there is a reason. And so it hasn't always been a very, you know, powerful crusade to go and discover it. Sometimes it was just, let's just go and then find out what the next thing is for me. But ultimately, it's been something that I haven't been able to see. It's almost like somebody's been there with me, just saying, keep going, and pushing me when I slow down. So at times that's turned into, I find something, like when I found the police department, that really gave me a lot of energy, gave me a sense of purpose that I felt good with. It you know, led me through SWAT. But whenever I think about resilience in the form of my conscious awareness of it, I was just channeling past pain in order to say, I've been through worse before. You know, this SWAT school is going to be terrible. It's going to hurt. But physical pain to me is nothing compared to the internal pain that I felt. So it might feel like my whole body's falling apart, but it doesn't matter because of what I've been through. So my entire life on that context, I was able to be successful and resilient through so many things because, again, physical pain to me is nothing compared to emotional or mental pain. But when I look at this overall context of just keep going, and I get down to that point of my second wife leaving me, I'm like, what did keep me going? What was my resilience? And to me, there's just no other explanation than it was God saying, there's something for you here, keep going, and you'll see.
Right. Well, so powerful. And just, you know, all the willingness to go back and experience that pain in order to kind of defuse the charge of it and lower the volume on it is, it just shows courage beyond belief. So very, very inspired by what you're saying, Laura. And I'd really love for you to talk a little more about the active shooter incident, the SWAT team, and your book, which is called Why I Went In, because it talks about choice. And I think choice is so important for people to hear about, that we do have choice, right? Every moment, every situation, we have a choice. So can you talk a little bit about all that?
Sure. So the active shooter was in May of 2019, and it was Memorial Day weekend. So I was supposed to be down at a post at the oceanfront in Virginia Beach for Patriotic Festival. And it was a little after 4 p.m. when the call came out for the active shooter at the Municipal Center, which was about 9 miles away from where it was at the oceanfront. So essentially the team, the department, everybody's responding from all over the city. And when I get there, I drove my own Tahoe, and it just so happened that I got behind another SWAT truck that had three other SWAT operators in it. And so when we show up to this massive building, you know, we don't really have good intel on which door to go in or anything like that. So we hop out of our cars, get the necessary equipment out of the trunk. And by necessary, I mean, it's, if you didn't already think about what you're grabbing on the way there, then there was no time to make sure you had the best gear on. Like, you know, we have rifle grade plates, but I went in there wearing my normal outer vest carrier because I didn't want to take the extra time to throw it on there, you know, especially because we had heard an officer had just been shot right before that we got there. So I'm going up to this building, and I have those three other SWAT operators with me. And, you know, it was automatic training at that point. We're like thinking what side of the building we're going into, how we're moving up. And as we're moving up to one of the doors, I notice in the parking lot there that there's rows of employee vehicles parked, and there's officers that are taking a position behind the vehicle. And I could just tell by looking at them that they weren't sure what they were supposed to be doing at the time. And I didn't stop to talk to them, but they looked like, we just don't know what to do here. So when we responded to the call, you know, all the information's out there, so I won't talk in depth about, you know, we got the guy in custody. He ended up dying on the way to the hospital because he was involved in a shootout with other officers right before we got there. However, I guess in the aftermath of the shooting, I never thought about, you know, what made me go in versus what made them go in. But I had that mental snapshot in my head of us moving towards there and then the other officers just staying outside. And it was sticking with me. And I ended up doing some EMDR after the fact about that, because I noticed, you know, in these traumatic events, it's usually those snapshots that are the things that stay with us and bother us. And for me, it wasn't just that. There were plenty of other victims inside that I also took those snapshots of. However, fast forward 2 years when I'm out hiking and my wife had just had an affair, and I'm just thinking about my life and how I got here and what is happening. What, like, that would have been a good opportunity for God to take me, you know. It's not that I was involved in the gunfight, but again, like, I responded to an active shooter. I'm still alive. I responded to all these other SWAT calls. I'm still alive. I responded to various, you know, calls as an officer, and I'm still alive. So what's going on, God? What are we doing here? Why am I alive? And so I just started breaking down that active shooter a little bit more. And I'm like, you know what, why did I go into this building in the first place? Because now I'm thinking in terms of a person, not as an officer, because I've turned in my badge and gun. And it just started dawning on me that, okay, that's what I was supposed to do. SWAT's supposed to go into active shooters. But it felt more like there was more than that. You know, when you answer a question and you feel that wasn't it. So I start looking, and I start looking at the three guys who I went in with. And I'm thinking, well, there's no way that I was going to let them go into that building by themselves and just stay outside. Like, those men were my brothers. I love them. I love their families. I wasn't going to do that. So that's number two. But then I'm still feeling like something's still not sitting with me. And then what I realized was I had to go in for myself because of who I was that day. I had to honor the woman that I was, and I had to choose me. And that's what Laura would have done, to go inside that building, to go and protect other people, to go in to have my brother's back, to do exactly what I said that I was going to do to honor my word as a SWAT operator. So much so that the job's telling me I should do this, but me saying I committed to doing this and that's what I'm going to do. So, you know, when I look at the other officers who didn't go in, I start trying to understand why, just from my own perspective, because we see that across the entire country. I guarantee in every active shooter situation, there's officers that don't go inside. And, you know, it's quick to label them as cowards and it's quick to say what everyone else would have done. But when I look at that individual and what they're capable of, if they haven't truly wrapped their mind around going into an active shooter, then I can understand why your survival mind really kicks in and says, wait a second, we're going to go do what? You're not prepared for this. You don't know what you're going to do. You have so much life ahead of you. And it just freezes them to the point of, I actually don't know what to do. What am I going to do when I get in there? And it's like, without the repetition of training that I know that I had as a SWAT officer, and without the mindset of saying I've committed to this ahead of time, then we don't always know how we're going to act when the day comes. And if we don't know how we're going to act, our body's going to tell us how we're going to act, because all our body cares about is survival. Our body doesn't care about our pride. Our body doesn't care about our source of income. You know, our body is telling us, okay, whatever, we're going to be rejected. So what? We'll go get another job somewhere else. People aren't going to even know that we were involved in this. And it'll start talking us into doing something, whatever that is, to keep us alive. So I don't know. I guess I take it way deeper than being able to just throw a label on somebody and saying like, well, you didn't do your job. Okay. How many people don't do their job on a given day? Right. Mm-hmm. So I just think there's so many more layers there to why somebody isn't going in to an active shooter. Now, can we fix that? Perhaps through training, through like more repetitions of training, or perhaps through focusing on the mindset that's going to be needed to go into these calls. But in Virginia Beach, it was just so unique because the active shooter happened about 400 yards away from our detective bureau. And, you know, for those in law enforcement that aren't just watching cops on TV, we know detectives are not the first ones on scene. They're not the ones going in the search warrant first on the door. You know, they're the ones getting there when the scene is safe. So on a given day, they're not thinking that their life is in jeopardy. They're not having to be in that same survival mindset and fighting through that to make those uncomfortable decisions and putting themselves in harm's way day after day after day, if their strict role on their job is to investigate crimes. It's just a different mindset. And so I have to personally take all those factors into consideration when I think of what allowed me to go in versus why other people didn't go in.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
I think it's an important point that you're making, because there's a lot of self-blame that first responders have when they don't have the reaction they would like, whether they're EMS, fire, police, dispatchers. I mean, they all have it in their own ways. So there's the self-doubt, but then there's also the criticism of others, which exists no matter what call we go on. You know, even I'm sure, David, when you go to rescue a fluffy kitten from a tree, there's still someone saying, like, why didn't you go up this branch instead of the other? Yeah. You know, and certainly as an EMS provider, I definitely had moments in my career where there's a moment that you are making a conscious decision to walk into total unknown and sometimes total danger. And people do react differently in those moments. And I think that shining a light on it and normalizing it and validating it is good and healthy for us to do, because the tendency is to always be critical, mean, angry, blaming, and that's not fair.
Right. And important to notice that that's coming externally, but even worse, coming internally.
Yeah.
When we're putting that anger, blame, shame, all of that onto ourselves, right, because of what we didn't do, which I think is a huge point in having grace for ourselves and having forgiveness for ourselves. Because I mentioned that lavender and honey exercise for painful things that I've experienced. I do the same thing with having to forgive myself for all the actions I've done in my life when I'm like, I don't think that was the best thing for me to do. And I have to show that same mm-hmm. grace and forgiveness for myself and realize I can't keep beating myself up for this my entire life, or I'm not going to view myself as worthy.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for unpacking all that. And, you know, it is a double whammy, the ways that we can kind of beat ourselves up on top of the external, you know, criticism or second guessing. And but really what you're talking about is a career defining or even life defining moment. And so much, I guess you've done a lot of self-exploration on that. And I think it's just incredible to have you share that with us. So thank you.
Absolutely.
I'd like to move into a little different topic. And that's, let's talk about female first responders. And obviously you've set the bar high and been a pioneer, at least in that department in Virginia Beach as a female SWAT operator. So what message do you have for female first responders?
So this is a little fresh for me. I've spent a lot of time with the other, that other element of pain and suffering. Okay. So, you know, in the intro, you mentioned that I'm into high performance coaching, and I also get coached myself. And recently I had a coaching session where I was trying to identify what was holding me back and preventing me from really exceeding into this next level of myself. And what it came down to was, I have this belief that I am less than because I'm a woman. And I wasn't even recognizing this ahead of time until I realized that things that I've felt and heard over the years have led me to think that women really are less capable than men. And I bought into it. You know, even in the law enforcement profession, there was like a separation, like, okay, women might be like this, but you're not women, you're Laura. You know, so it's like I was getting this this pass because of however the way I was doing things while discrediting the female part of it. So over time, what I've come to realize is I didn't even realize how much I was buying into that same belief that because I'm a woman, I don't have the same capability. And if I'm going to be successful, I need to separate myself from being woman as much as possible. I need to become a man, essentially. In order to be successful. And so it blows my mind because I never took the time to help other women while I was on the police department, at least not to the way that I would have if I'd go back now and do that. Just because, you know, I always wish that there could be more females that would go into SWAT without necessarily honoring all the females that don't want to go into SWAT. You know, so I'm looking at it like looking around, looking left and right, saying, hey, where are the other females that want to do what I'm doing? And there's truly not nearly as many on these or in these positions. So, like I said, I'm still working through this a little bit. But for me, it's learning how to accept that I'm a female and that I want to be a female and that I can be just as successful even though I'm a woman, because I think what I had told myself was I was successful despite being a woman and that I had to overcome being a woman in order to be successful. So then that didn't make me proud to be a woman, made me say like, well, this is a part of me that I can't change or don't want to change. And therefore I'm stuck with it, but can you help me? Can you help recognize I'm still good enough? And I mean, there are plenty of examples where, I mean, even to this day where I someone's looking for an answer, I say what the answer is and they don't believe you. And then they have to go and trust and verify it with somebody else. And it's just kind of like, when is my voice going to be heard and recognized and given the credit for the intelligence that I have, the experience that I have? And so many times I've just had memories and examples of, okay, fine. This is how it is.
Well, and how much of that is in first responder world, they started off as male cultures, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that over time, women have gotten more and more involved in all branches and now leadership. And there were probably so many growing pains for those women that even came before us. I feel fortunate because I really never felt that it was a barrier for myself. It was never really at the forefront. It was kind of like the sky's the limit where I practiced EMS, which I'm very grateful for. But I do realize that for a lot of people, it is more top of mind, or it is more in their face, or they feel like they have to contend with it more. And I think it seems that as a woman, we have a conscious choice sometimes to make for other women. So I remember being in situations where I would make a choice because I knew it would help other women, not necessarily me, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for me, I've certainly heard of other women, you know, their male counterparts won't necessarily trust them. So if they're partnered up, then the male counterpart doesn't want to go and be as proactive because they don't trust that the female with them is going to be able to help them. For me personally, part of my uphill battle was that I was the second female on the SWAT team and the first female who I didn't know, but before my time, was involved with a lawsuit for the team for different harassment and discrimination while she was on the team. And, you know, I'm not here to speculate on that because I don't like talking about anything I wasn't personally involved in. So aside that, though, when I first went over to the team and I would walk through a precinct, they would say, how are they treating you over there? Are they treating you okay? Are they treating you fairly? So it's like I didn't even have a chance over there without people already assuming that I would be treated differently because I was a female, or just thinking that I had some uphill battle already because I was a female and it's being projected onto me. So again, in my head, the thing that I wanted to do was separate myself from being female as much as possible. And I mean, I am a lesbian, so in a sense that may have helped me fit in with the guys a little bit more at times. But yeah, I tried to separate myself from being a female because I wanted to be with the team and I didn't want anybody to view me as different, even though I was. I'm 5'3", 120 pounds and the only female on the team. Like, I stand out. But for me, again, everything was about belonging, going all the way back to being adopted. Everything's about belonging and not sticking out, not being different. And in this case, in the profession, not belonging has been being female.
In terms of, you know, your post-career, what you're up to now, can you share with us a little bit about some of the things you're doing?
Absolutely. So I'm in Chicago right now, and I'm instructing with the professional law enforcement training, referred to as PLET sometimes. But yeah, we're up here in Chicago, Illinois, and instructing the Chicago Police Department right now. I'm part of the constitutional law course, which I'm absolutely loving, getting to know so many different officers. I mean, this department is huge compared to Virginia Beach. There's over 12,000 officers here. So it's a little eye-opening to see how things operate here versus where I worked in Virginia Beach. But yeah, being back into this law enforcement community has been so, it's made me come alive in a way that I wasn't sure that I was missing ahead of time, because when I left the police department from Virginia Beach, I wanted to just take the rearview mirror off and just go and just heal and not look back. Not saying I was burning bridges or anything like that and saying I didn't want to be friends with people, but you get it. You know, I just wanted to go and heal and start a new chapter. But what I found is in my self-discovery journey in trying to figure out where I belong, I've realized that even though that was my initial plan, that God has redirected me back and saying, okay, you've done yourself work. Now let's go back to police department and do what you had said you were going to do. But now I get to do it from an outside perspective and reach so many more people than I would have. And this, just this week, after meeting someone last week, a female officer brings me a copy of my book for me to sign for her. And I just thought that was amazing, you know, because again, all those thoughts and ideas, my life was just in my head. I put it on paper. I published it. I've been out to Oregon and given copies of my book to people out there when I did a keynote speech. Now I've brought it to Chicago and just things are unfolding for me in ways that I could not have planned for them to unfold, but it all feels right where I'm supposed to be.
Well, that's amazing. And a couple of times you used the word for, like things happening for you as opposed to you. And I love that perspective in that it's, you know, it shifts the whole narrative in a different way, in a much more positive light.
Exactly. And we talked about suffering earlier. It felt like things were happening to me, mm-hmm. you know, and that's been one of the biggest takeaways for me is that pain doesn't happen to me. It often happens for me as a growth opportunity. So whether it's a painful situation or whether it's a opportunity that I view in more favorable light, it's all for me. And then it depends on what actions that I want to take when that comes into my life.
Great.
Well, and David and I have talked about this before, but we're both not working in the profession right now on the road, but definitely feel the way you do, right? Like you can take everything you learned, you take your leadership experience, you take it all with you, and you realize that you have so much to offer and skills and just insight and wisdom that you get to when you look back, right? And I think what you're saying, and Dave and I agree, is that you can use everything you learned still, but instead of helping your patients or the fire victims or whomever, now we're helping our own in a way that we couldn't do when we were in the profession. So I think if we look at it that way, you know, and realizing that sometimes when we move forward, it's because we had to, and it's because you're going to touch so many more people.
I 100% agree with that, because through this journey, I've thought maybe I should go back to being a police officer, and everything's told me I'm not going to be able to have the impact while I'm standing side by side. And it's not that I'm standing above or below. It's that right. I'm just standing with a little bit of a different perspective. And a lot of that perspective is someone who's put in the work to heal. And so now I have this light or this fire and this flame that I can come bring to other people that are experiencing their darkness and unable to get out of that. So I realized that the solution is not to go and pull everyone from first responder
right.
you know, professions, because we need first responders. So how do we get into first responders and heal them where they're at so that they can continue being first responders throughout their entire life and do so in a healthy way? Because right now the life expectancy of a police officer after retiring is, I think, 3 to 6 years. And that's unacceptable to me. You know, we say we have to stay on a job for a pension, but then you're only getting your pension for 3 to 6 years. Or by that point, you know, your family connections, your friend connections are not really that strong, and you're feeling isolated. So to me, for police, fire, EMS, everybody, first responder community, I view it as noble. I view it as a noble contribution that we're willing to give that part of our lives to do what other people don't want to do so that everybody can be free, our families, the community, everybody. And so it's not right that there's a punishment and a sentencing and truly a sacrifice associated with that, as if we're donating our lives and saying, well, I just don't get to enjoy a good life because I'm a first responder. Like that two doesn't add up, you know? Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. almost like we're in a free prison, and it shouldn't be that way. So I'm determined to find a way of making it a more enjoyable existence for everybody who's a first responder.
Well, that is amazing. And thank you for having that mission. It's so much needed.
And thank you both, because again, you're here making it so other officers, other first responders, firefighters, EMS, everybody can be a part of the conversation and start getting a new perspective that will help them grow in their own lives.
As we wrap up, can you share with us where we can find your book, Why I Went In, and other places people can reach you on social media or internet?
Absolutely. So my book is on Amazon. It's also, if you're more of a Barnes & Noble person, it's on there as well as Kindle and eBooks. If you have an iPad, that's your role, or that's your route you can take. But it's on Amazon, Why I Went In by Laura G. Hansen. And my social media platform, I'm constantly putting things on there, again, trying to help with mindset and perspective. So my Instagram is at Laura, L-A-U-R-A, underscore G, underscore Hansen, H-A-N-S-O-N.
Fantastic. From my perspective, you've made an amazing contribution here today just by sharing your story and being so honest and open that I'm sure is going to touch somebody out there who really needs to hear it. So thank you so much for being part of this conversation, Laura.
Absolutely. I'm truly blessed to be here with both of you. Again, this is an opportunity that's come into my life for me, and you two have really helped me, really sparked all of this energy in me to go forth and continue this mission. So thank you.
Well, we're grateful, and you have come for everyone here as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Remember to go to our YouTube channel, it's Respond to Resilience, and subscribe there. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., Responder TV. We're also on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other platforms for podcasts. And our website is respondertv.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.